911, what's your emergency?
You want to go for the title?
Sir, sexual harassment is a crime.
And for the listeners at home, it is.
It is. Not trying to imply that Buck was sexually harassing Eddie when he said that. We're just trying to imply that it is an inherently sexual thing to say.
I will say, though, the way that that scene just popped up out of nowhere in this episode did genuinely feel like harassment.
No, it was a jump scare.
Buddy this swung episode, at me so hard.
There were several points in this episode where I was like, oh, it's that episode.
Mm-hmm.
But like on the whole as an episode, it doesn't necessarily make that much of an impression.
No, because it's not a cohesive, like, you know, semblance of like storylines, right? And so like you have all these like different like angles it's like coming at. And, you know, you look back on the episode and you're like, I can see how all of those details would have gotten lost in just how messy this one was. Like, this episode is so messy that the copaganda storyline feels like the Joey Jeremiah subplot. Like, this is like, it's the first time in the show where big issue cop stuff feels like the B plot. You know?
And I mean, in that sense, maybe we should be grateful.
But, like, the absolute, like, tonal dissonance of this episode, like, it might be one of the most egregious examples we've encountered so far in this show. And I honestly think that that's very funny.
I mean, it's not, like, that bad.
But it kind of is, because, like, we'll get into it. But, like, it's such, like, such a swing when Buddy comes at you. Fast like life, or when, you know, living with the enemy, you know, jumps up out of the bush, and then Maddie's doing her whole thing. It's such a strange balance this episode. It's like that clip that made Brittany Broski famous of her trying kombucha. And it's like, you know.
Ooh, you know what? Well, I have been drinking this mango lime kombucha from the grocery store where I work, and it is really good. So I can't relate to Brittany Broski liking and disliking kombucha. I just like it.
Nice.
This isn't an ad for kombucha.
Well, I'm glad we're both mixing things up, because I have decided to take a break from my Diet Coke fiendery. And so I'm now drinking Coke Zero. I bought
a
12 pack of Coke Zero at the store, and I'm like, you know what? I'm just gonna like sip this until I miss Diet Coke. And I opened it and I took one sip and I missed Diet Coke. But I had already bought the 12 pack, and so I'm like, you know what? I'm just gonna commit to it. I'm not gonna buy any more until I finish this. It's fine. Everything is fine.
A scathing indictment of Coke Zero on the First Risk podcast.
I'm glad to see that people in our comments. Sorry, this is unrelated, but glad to see people in our comments are like sort of validating our tea with like season 3 not living up to its own hype. It's been an interesting revelation to like watch through these episodes and be like, huh, I guess the show kind of had a flop era, like a mini flop era in season 3, huh?
Yeah, and nobody acknowledges it in the fandom. Somebody in our YouTube comments was saying something about like, oh, it's funny to watch you guys slowly realize that this isn't a very good show. And I was like, no. Okay, no.
No.
Listen.
Let's
push
back.
Not that. It's like we did earnestly enjoy seasons 1 and 2, right?
Yeah.
Like there were only,
oh my god, yeah.
I think there was only like 1 or 2 episodes in season 2 that we were like, oh, that one like wasn't quite as strong. Mm-hmm. Like we really liked the show, and it's true, as I've said before, it could also be true that, like, since watching season 8, like, our love of the show, like, we're seeing it through kind of a different filter now, but I do think, like, I am not one of the people who believes that 911 is, like, a bad show by default.
Yeah.
I sometimes see people in the fandom be like, yeah, this show is bad, but we like it anyway. And it's like, well, no. Like, there was at least a time where it was quite competent television.
No, you know? I totally
agree.
Sure,
it wouldn't win, like, an Emmy, but it was it was good, solid network TV.
No, I totally agree. And you see this, like, historical revisionism happening all the time. Like, it's so common, like, amongst, like Glee fans to be like, oh, yeah, the show's always been bad, but we've loved it anyways. And I'm like, no, the show was good, and then it got bad. I don't know, like, what's another example? Like, actually, you know what? I'm not going to lie, Jane. My roommate is watching through Supernatural right now. and I'm finding season one to be quite compelling.
Oh, I thought it was so boring when I tried to rewatch it last, but, you know, I give that it was, like, fine. I don't think it was terrible.
No, I mean, it's definitely, like, later seasons of Supernatural, like, pretty much everything past season five is terrible. But I'm sort of remembering what I really liked about this show, and I'm like, oh, wait, this show did used to be good. Or, like, you know, when you look back on, like when Teen Wolf was really good, or, like, when Vampire Diaries was really good, like, those shows were genuinely good TV. And it's just, like, through the lens of hindsight that it's like, oh, no, it's bad and trash and has always been trash. And it's, I don't think so. I don't think so, buddy. I think part of what we're doing here, buddy, I think part of what we're doing here is, like, you know, trying to appreciate when the show is really good and shine a light on that. And it's just so happens that we're having a string of, you know, really bad episodes. And this episode,
well, it's what you said, it's like not a flop era. And yeah, I think it's just it's interesting to realize, because we were not previously aware that this was a flop era, and now we're discovering it. But not to call out that one person in our comments specifically, thank you for listening.
We love you. We welcome you. Thank you for supporting our pod.
Yes, just a little counterpoint to the idea that this show is actually bad. I think, like, and I think that makes it all the more frustrating when it is bad, is you're like, I've seen you do better than this. Like, I know that you can do it. So, you know, this what's show, going on here?
This show is a student that just needs to apply itself. I think we've said this before, right? Like,
well, it's like, it's my perspective on Eddie is like, I'm his stern but loving swim coach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, we're like, anyway, you know, we're the guidance counselor trying to get things back on track so they can get into a good college.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. We're like, you're never going to graduate at this rate, 911. So with that, very, very, you know, inspiring intro that bodes very well for everything we're about to talk about, let's get into season 3, episode 9, Fallout, directed by Marcus Stokes, written by Juan Carlos Coto. You all remember Juan. He's been around. He will continue to be around. We open with this woman raking her lawn, and there's somebody on the radio talking about how there's a meteor shower, like, narrowly missing Los Angeles.
As if things couldn't get bad enough. Earthquake, most devastating tsunami in U.S. history by, like, a really wide margin. Why not just, you know, the gods smiting down the people of L.A. with a storm of rocks from space? Why not?
But you don't worry about it, guys. The meteor shower is going to miss us. So then this, like, fake Amazon delivery person walks up. It's, like, not actually Amazon, but it's clearly styled to be Amazon. They walk up, drop off a package at this house that is apparently owned by this raking woman. A young woman answers the door. It's, like, a tenant landlady situation. Mm-hmm. So this woman answers the door. It's a young woman. She's not looking so good. She's got, like, really red, puffy eyes. Mm-hmm. She picks up the package, and the landlady's like, I'm worried about you. Like, you know, you've been cooped up in that house for a while. And upon bringing the package inside, the woman's like, yeah, well, I recently got fired from my content creation job.
Insane.
For, quote, not getting the voice of the blog.
Okay.
Which, like, I would be upset too.
I would be upset too, but I do have to ask, how many blogs nowadays are actively paying people? Right? I feel like that...
True. Like, in 2019, would a blog really be... I mean, who knows?
Like, were you co-moderating, like a Tumblr blog or something like that? Like, what? Like, was this, like, a Star Wars fandom thing, and you were making some cash on the side? You had a coffee link or something?
Well, it could have been, like, a company hired a social media person to manage all of their social medias, and one of their outlets was a blog.
Yeah, I'm just curious to know which company and the internal structures... But
it was probably like Uber or Sweetgreen or, you know, one of these annoying modern companies that doesn't pay you well, but they have like a staff frozen yogurt bar, and that's supposed to make up for it.
But basically, this fuck-ass millennial is wallowing in her misery. She's a crust queen. She is, you know, fully indulging in the self-pitying. And, like, I get it. Like, I totally get her. You know, she ordered a weighted blanket from Amazon. That's why it's so heavy. It's a weighted blanket. And she says she says it's like a constant hug, right? She has it on, and she's... She's just
lying on the couch under the weighted blanket. She's listening to affirmations.
I love this woman so much. I feel like we've all been her at one point or another, so instantly relatable. And then God says, fuck this one person in particular, you know?
Yeah.
Zeus smites her down because one of those meteors goes rogue from the pack and strikes her home. And fucking burns a hole right through her side while she's under the blanket.
Right through fusing the weighted blanket and her torso and her couch, like down into the earth.
Fusing the blanket and the chaise lounge to her body. Wow.
God said, you want a weighted blanket? Well, here's a permanent weighted blanket.
Yeah, so the 118 responds, of course. The lady on the phone says, the sky is falling.
Well, there's a 911 call, and the landlady, says, the sky is falling.
Like she's Chicken Little, right? It's great.
Like she's Chicken Little.
And they see her, and it turns out, because the meteor was, like, you know, so hot, because it was burning up in the atmosphere, not only did it, you know, like, fuse the blanket and the couch to her skin, it also completely cauterized the wound, and by some miracle, missed most, if not all, of her vital organs. Her pain is at a 4, right?
Hey, it's not that bad.
There's no
she
bleeding.
She should really just pull herself up by her bootstraps.
Seriously, because there's no bleeding, the nerve endings are completely fried, so she's not feeling anything other than, like, sort of a general throbbing pain in her side. And she has a fucking hole in her. She has a fucking hole in her side. This is
a
why
hole
everyone
so big that Buck can go under the couch and look up at Bobby and wave through the hole.
Oh my God. And then he finds the meteorite, and I swear to God, it's like a dog with a stick, you know?
He gets really excited. He says, should I grab it?
And Chim's like, Chim,
and
the
Bobby's
party pooper
like, it doesn't
over here
belong to you.
Yeah. Chim but says, that, it belongs yeah, in like, a museum. You know? I heard
yeah,
actually.
Which, it's like, come on. I feel like meteorites are fair game, like public domain. I feel like it's whoever first grabs it gets it. Like, you know, there's no land deed on that meteorite.
Yeah, but Chim has to be over here invoking Indiana Jones, saying this belongs in a museum. Like, who are you? Let him have his stick. It's fine.
Yeah.
That'd be the coolest thing on his shelf, you know? and he could take it to a scientist or whatever to, like, have it looked at, and then he could keep it, like, this is my property, I found it, and get it framed, or, like, whatever you call it when you get it, like, a display for it, and put it up, and it's a constant conversation piece for, like, the end of time. He could gift it to
but
his child.
Buck is trying to sort of cheer up this woman, and he says, only one other person in history has ever been hit by a meteorite, and that was in the 50s. So, displaying some random knowledge, she asks how he knows that, and Eddie, Buck's wife, says that Buck was on the pier when the tsunami hit, and therefore he's now become obsessed with natural disasters.
Yeah, but this woman, she's like, why me? Why was I punished? And Buck sort of turns this around on her and says, like, hey, you know, you might be the luckiest person on Earth because, well, the implication, you're going to get rich and famous off of this story.
Right. Which
and
is a
she
hilarious
will,
thing
you know?
To imply. But we do see her do that by the end of the episode. So
yeah, like, good for
know,
her, honestly.
It's L.A.
It's L.A.
You can be famous
right
for anything.
Yeah, she does the talk show circuit. She's mentioned in medical journals, like, she's on the Wikipedia page. And, you know, she starts doing TED Talks about being struck by a meteorite and learning lessons about perseverance. It's
great.
Right,
and how it encouraged her to start her evil soul-sucking startup or whatever in Silicon Valley.
She starts, like, a Talk to a style podcast, like,
oh, yeah.
I don't know.
Meteor to a
meteor to a struck to a or something because you're struck by the meteor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And finally, you know, this does seem to cheer her up a little bit. And as everybody's clearing out of the house, Chimney says, can't believe Hen missed this. And then title card, because yes, Hen is not there. And in fact, we cut to Hen in therapy with Frank. I think this might be our first Frank sighting. Frank is like the new department therapist.
Yeah, I was I was curious because as the scene goes on, I guess a department therapist is a real thing and is a valuable asset. But I was curious how much of a conflict of interest it was to have multiple patients that all know each other.
Well, I was a little confused at why they would have the same therapist for the fire department and the 911 dispatch, because we see that Maddie is also going to this therapist. It's like, obviously they work together a lot, but they're not like overseen. They're not the same departments. They're not like overseen by the same people.
He's the one city therapist. City
departments.
For all like LA city officials, he's the one therapist.
That might check out.
It might, but like now he's like, you know, as overworked as a public defender, if not more so. And so
maybe that's why he's kind of a bad therapist.
Yo.
It all makes sense. Tim Minear is smart, you guys.
He is.
We kind of start cutting between three different characters going to therapy with Frank. We've got Hen is in therapy. She's talking about having nightmares following this accident. Her little oopsie where she ran over a civilian with her ambulance. We see that Eddie is in therapy with Frank. He's like, I'm sorry. I like don't even know how to describe what's going on with Eddie because I think it's so poorly thought out by the show.
Yeah.
He's talking about like not feeling any emotions. He's like, there are all these moments where like I'm watching my kid have fun and I should be feeling joy, but I just feel nothing. And it's like, wait, where did this come from? You know, this is what I was trying to get at in my video where like, Eddie's emotional storylines to me always feel really like told and not shown. You know, we get told these things about Eddie and I'm just like, what? When? Like, I never saw that be true about him.
Well, it feels like conflicting storytelling, right? Because like, you know, the whole thing is that they were telling us that he's feeling intense bursts of anger, right? And it was probably grief related and, you know, stress related and whatever. And that's why he was, you know, doing the underground fighting ring. He was settling it in the ring. But then now here he is being like, yeah, I'm completely numb to life. It's like classic depression symptoms. And I'm like, I don't know a lot of depressed people who, you know, when they experience intense bursts of anger that are trauma related, go out and do fight clubs. I don't know. I don't want to harp on the fight club thing, but.
So for one thing, I mean, one symptom of depression can be anger or irritability or probably even rage, but I was also just watching like some TLC reality show where somebody was meeting up with one of those like shitty TV therapists, but the therapist said something to them. I was just thinking about this because I was like, oh, what was I just watching that was about this exact thing? They were trying to tackle some guy's problem where he was like getting really mad at his family. Like he would have a really short temper and they said something about how like if you're bottling up your emotions all of the time, you're going to start to only feel one emotion, and that's anger. And so in defense of the show, according to this TLC TV therapist, I think it might be true that like repressing your emotions could lead you to have anger issues. And also, they don't say that in this scene. So yeah, it kind of feels like there's no correlation. Like they don't even mention the anger at all.
There's just no link to it, you know?
Kind of disconnected.
Yeah, that's the problem, is that there's no link to it. They're not actually like, you know, putting in the connective tissue. So you're supposed to make the inference yourself. And we're given so little to work on with Eddie's like inner world that it just comes off as like a complete non sequitur, you know?
Yeah, he doesn't say like, you know, in the moments where I feel like I should be feeling something, I'm not feeling anything, but then any little thing will set me off and I'll get angry. He just says, like, I don't feel anything. And it feels like this brand new thing that we've never heard about or seen from him.
Yeah.
So that's weird. But finally, we also see Maddie in therapy with Frank. She is, of course, doing her, like, government-mandated therapy that her work is making her do after stalking this lady. She is, like, not receptive to it. She thinks it isn't helpful. She's saying, like, you know, I'm only here because my work is making me do it. I did a ton of therapy after the incident with Doug and, like, whatever. Like, I'm over it. But finally, we hear their reasons for coming to therapy. We kind of see all of them, like, expressing their reasons for going to therapy. Maddie says, I was ordered by my boss. Hen says, I know I need help to process this. So she's kind of like winning therapy between the three of them, which of course your goal in therapy should always be to win, right?
Of course. You should always A, try to impress your therapist, B, win the interaction, and C, come off not only as like cool and normal, but also admired in some way. That's the goal. That's the goal, is to be admired by your therapist.
Exactly. That's the way to do it. They don't always tell you this, but that is the way you are supposed to approach it. That's what I do when I go to therapy. So Hen is...
It's what I would do if I had health insurance.
No, same. So Hen of the three of them is sort of being the most like rational and healthy. She's saying, I know I need help to process this. She's being receptive to help. Eddie says, I don't want my kid to be like me. Very sad thought for him to express. Again, it's like, I think this would hit harder if we had seen this whole emotional thing about Eddie, like, actually expressed through scenes between him and Christopher, instead of, like, him and, like, Bobby just, like, telling us that there are things wrong with him. But whatever. I do think that line is poignant on its own.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I was actually kind of feeling for him in that scene. And that actually felt like it had a thesis for the character.
And I did think it was a good Ryan Guzman performance in that scene.
Oh, yeah, definitely, because you could tell it was, like, coming from, like, kind of, like, you know, an emotionally true place, you know? And that's, I feel like that's when he does his best work, is when, like, he's, you know, leaning back on, like, the father angle, leaning back on, like, sort of the guilt angle, or like, the emotional repression, because that does feel like it's coming from, like, sort of an emotional truth that he's really good at exploring. So that it was good playing to his strengths there. And then they do this very strange sort of like match cut of, you know, Eddie saying, I nearly beat a guy to death. And Hen saying, I crashed into a girl and she died. And then Maddie saying, I killed my husband. And I, like, I understand.
It's kind of funny when they line them all up together like that, right?
I understand what they're driving at, right? That they're all dealing with their own sort of feelings of guilt, right? But I don't think Maddie's Doug guilt is comparable to the guilt felt by Eddie and Hen, and I don't think Eddie's guilt is comparable to Hen's guilt either. So it was just kind of a little strange, but I got what they were going for. Right?
Yeah, I just found it kind of funny to hear them, like, all list their crazy things that they've done. It's like, it almost feels like an edit someone made of, like, putting together moments where they've, like, talked about their crazy storylines.
It's like a fan cam edit.
It just comes off a
like,
little goofy to acknowledge that the show has done this many crazy things this recently.
It's like a fan cam, and it culminates in, like, sort of, like shots of, like, them, like, killing or almost killing these people, like, with, like, a shoujo anime filter and, like, I don't know, like a Taylor Swift song over it.
Yeah. So back at the station, presumably later, Buck and Chimney and Eddie are all asking Bobby about Hen, like when she'll be back, what's going on with her. And we kind of get onto the topic of therapy. And Eddie says that he isn't sure he and Frank are clicking, which, yeah, they don't really seem to. I don't know. I don't know why the show cares to make this a thing, because I feel like they don't really explore it much in this season. Yeah. But Bobby mentions in this whole exchange that the therapist Buck slept with in season one doesn't work for the department anymore.
Yeah.
That's probably for the best.
Definitely
for the best. It's not clarified if she, like, was fired or if she just doesn't work for that specific department anymore.
I mean, given how openly Buck speaks about it and sort of the intimacy with which Bobby seems to understand the situation, it's plausible that maybe you know, Buck told him about it, Bobby filed a complaint, and then she was removed from her position, which
she
deserved.
She was, like, stripped of her license.
I mean, she probably should be, right?
Like, probably should have been, if not.
During this scene where they're gossiping, I do want to say that, like, I had a moment where, like, I was flashing back to, oh god, which episode was it? It was one of the recent ones we just did where they're at Buck's loft, and it's Buck and Chim and Maddie, and they're talking about how they just tell each other everything about each other all the time, all day, because there's nothing else to do. And I'm like, huh,
yeah,
that's so true.
It's kind of fun to see that play out. Eddie, we find out Eddie had not heard about Buck sleeping with his therapist, so he's like, whoa, like, what's that about? Buck says, like, I was going through a phase, like, you know, didn't you just go through one of those? And it's like, touche. Suddenly Athena arrives. She is back on the beat and no longer on probation, you know, free to terrorize the citizens of LA once more.
The enemy has infiltrated the firehouse. I can't. The enemy has infiltrated.
Well, oh right. Boy. Athena sees that May has emailed her college essay. She's like, oh, great, let me open it. At this point in the episode, I wrote in my notes, oh no, it's this episode. Eddie has a line acknowledging the existence of his sisters,
yes,
which is always interesting.
Eddie's
sisters
mentioned.
He remembers the drama. Mm-hmm. He remembers the drama when his sisters were applying to college. So, you know, that's interesting. His sisters went to college, but not him. And then he says, I think it's half the reason I decided to join the army. And I was like, no, no, no.
No.
Wait a second. What the fuck is this timeline? How old are Eddie's sisters? And are they older or younger? I think that maybe early in the show, they assumed that Eddie's sisters were older, but then later retconned it for them to be younger, because we eventually hear in season 5 that they must have been younger. We hear that, like, Eddie, like, crashed his dad's car trying to take his mom to the hospital when she was in labor with one of them. And I think it's implied that both of them are younger. But then here, it's like, Eddie, how would your sisters have been applying to college before you made the decision to join the military, which happened when you were, like, 18?
No, if I may white knight for the messy timeline for a moment.
Okay.
I am going to go out on a limb and say, he saw the craziness with his sisters applying to college and their personal essays and the stress and all that. And he reflected back on when he was faced with the prospect of applying to college. And he saw the writing on the wall with the personal essays and felt that same emotion and said, nah, I'm going to go into the army. And then when he saw his sisters going through that, he's like, psh, glad I didn't have to do that. So that's my take on it.
So you're interpreting
that's
the
my
line
take
as
on
more
it.
Of like... Mm-hmm. You're interpreting the line as, like, kind of divorced from the sentiment of remembering the drama with... Yeah, I get what you mean.
I think,
like,
I
a retroactive...
Just, yeah, I think there's a period in there somewhere is my only mm-hmm. take on it. But then Athena opens...
Well, fair enough.
Athena opens May's essay, and in all caps, a very large font, it just says, Living with the Enemy by May Grant.
It turns out that... based young May Grant
yes
written her college essay about what it's like, the conflicting emotions she feels being both an anti-racist and someone who's experienced racial profiling with the police and having her mom be a police officer. And I think she's real cool for this, and obviously we agree with her perspective 100%.
Yeah.
But Athena immediately is like, wow, I can't believe my bitch daughter would betray me like this.
She literally, like, she says, like, I'm gonna kill that little girl, or whatever.
Yeah, it's like, girl, this is not...
She didn't even read the essay yet. It's like on Twitter when, like, you see a headline and you get mad at it before you even open the article.
Yeah.
It's exactly that.
But that's sort of like our cliffhanger for that scene.
And I just say, she's doing all of this and making this fool out of herself. And they've the wig that they've styled for Angela Bassett in this scene is, I think they've teased it too much because it has too much volume, and so it looks like it's trying to eat her head. It's this strange balance of, like, sort of voluminous, but also, like, has a professional hedge fund manager-esque side swoop. It does not fit. And also, you never see, like, it styled this way again. Like, in the next scene with her, it's back to normal. I just had to call attention to that it was, maybe it was an early morning and, you know, the stylist was going at it with one eye open. I don't know. There is a possibility, but you definitely notice it. But anyways, that scene ends that way.
Well, then we go to Bobby and Hen at the station. Mm-hmm. And apparently the report about the accident has come out. And the report shows that the accident wasn't Hen's fault in the slightest. Her light was indeed green, but so was Evelyn's. Like, her light never changed. There was some sort of error with the circuit board.
A malfunction, you might say.
A malfunction, if you will. And Bobby says to her, you did everything right. Which, I touched on this in our last episode, that I do think this is kind of a cop-out that makes the storyline less interesting.
Yeah.
Like, I get that. I guess it would be hard to bring the story back around if it turned out that Hen was responsible for, like, killing this girl. But I also think it's kind of like, why even have this happen at all if you're not going to grapple with like her having any responsibility at all? If it's just going to be like, don't worry, Hen, you did everything right.
Yeah.
Like totally unambiguous.
From that angle, it does feel almost like kind of needlessly cruel in that it's just like, let's just kill this random young woman and have no culpability for the person driving the ambulance.
Right. It was just like a city works issue. Sorry, family of that girl.
And the story does suffer because you see Hen like grappling with later on in the episode, you see her grappling with like, if I can't trust my instincts, then I don't know what good I'm going to be at this job. I feel like I'm betraying myself. And it's like, well, that would be a really interesting character conflict to have, an internal conflict. But there's literally nothing that she did wrong and nothing that she could have done differently short of stopping at at the light rather than, you know, changing it to green when she's in an ambulance with someone who's dying. Like, which, by the way, never find out what happened to Piss Boy from Amazon, right? Like, we never find out if he lived or died.
He probably flatlined in the back of the
Probably, because no one was looking after him and the ambulance crashed. He probably just died and nobody mentioned him again. Was that not weird?
Well, I think they mentioned something about when the crash happens. It's like I think the reason they call the 118 is because like the rest of the 118 to come respond is like now they need to tend to this girl and transport the guy in like a different vehicle. I think they like call for another ambulance or something.
Oh, I must have missed it.
Nevertheless, Hen is still feeling responsible for what happened. Obviously, like, and it's true that, like, just because you learned that you technically weren't culpable, like, that doesn't mean you didn't drive the ambulance into someone and it resulted in their death. So, like, yeah, you would probably still feel responsible. She mentions that she and Karen are going away for a few days. And, you know, when Bobby says that she's free to come back to work whenever, Hen says she still needs some time.
Which is reasonable. It's reasonable that she needs time to readjust after that, because it is kind of a life-altering thing to happen. So you get it, and you definitely feel for Hen in this scene. But it cuts off there, and we'll pick it up in a couple of scenes, because back at the Grant household, Athena is actually reading the article.
The essay, yeah. She
many of you can't relate.
She read beyond the headline, yeah. And she is reading the essay with disgust.
With
absolute disgust.
Disdain. It's visceral on her face. I'm like, immediately it's like Michael is there trying to talk sense into her, like he points out that she takes time to sort of praise you and say that she looks up to you, and this is why she has this internal conflict. And you know, May is allowed to feel these things. Like, May is allowed to have this like internal like dialogue about this and to voice it in this form, because sort of from an objective perspective, Athena is the misguided cop that she's getting so offended over being painted as, right?
Yeah.
And it seems like, and obviously we haven't read the essay because it's not a real essay, the show is fiction, but it, from the way it's described by her other loving parent who's, you know, read it, and was talking to May about the process of writing it, it seems like she's writing a very even-handed essay about her own personal misgivings.
Yeah.
While, you know, paying respect where it's due and voicing this conflict with a lot of nuance. And Athena's over here just nah, you know?
Even the way Athena describes it makes it sound very reasonable. She says, like, oh, so my daughter's portraying me as, you know, some misguided cop who's trying to fix a broken system. And it's like, well, yeah, Athena, that's exactly what is happening.
Yeah, for a straw man, that is very nuanced, right? Like,
right. But she learns that Michael actually already knew about the essay, that May had talked to Michael about it before telling Athena, because, he says, she was worried about her mom's reaction. And, like, this is exactly what she thought would happen, is yes, Athena is just really angry about it and refusing to see May's side of it. But Michael just encourages her to tell May that she loves and supports her, even if she disagrees with her. And Athena's response to that is, "That's easy for you to say, because you're not the enemy." And I just thought this was so immature, yeah. You know, like as a parent, I thought that was such an immature reaction of, yeah, like being unable to divorce. You know, she's obviously seeing this essay as a personal attack on her.
Yeah.
When, like you said, it sounds like it's focused on May's internal struggle with this idea, mm-hmm. and like the sort of general attitude and culture around the police. It's not like a point by point, you know, teardown of Athena Grant personally. And I understand why, like, you would feel defensive of your career if your kid made an essay like this. But also, I think she's reacting in a very kind of immature, irrational way about it instead of being... I think Michael's being a great mediator here.
Yeah.
And trying to just encourage her to, even if she does fundamentally disagree, to just kind of accept that her daughter... He says something very poignant to her where he says, like, we always said that we would let our children grow up to, like, have their own minds and speak their minds and figure out the world for themselves. And, like, the fact that May feels this way means that we did our jobs. And Athena's kind of caught up on literally just, like, the title of the essay, like you said.
No, it's true. I mean, like, in fairness to Athena, she does seem to take this on. And the resolution of this mm-hmm. episode is a lot better than the last two that dealt with the propaganda thing. And this is kind of why I'm of two minds about this, right? Because on the one hand, I do, you know, on an emotional level, I do understand Athena's defensiveness, and I do understand this reaction. And, like, again, to her credit, like, at least she's not having this, like, reaction to May's face. Like, she's, you know, dealing with this mm-hmm. in private before talking to her about it. So I guess points to Athena for that. But, you know, there, like, at the same time, you would kind of hope that, you know, a parent would be able to take themselves outside of it. I mean, then again, maybe it is realistic because a lot of parents are sort of impulsive and immature and childish about a lot of things. So I don't know. I'm of two minds about this because it is a marked improvement from the last couple of times the show handled propaganda. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, like the fundamental flaw for this storyline for me is that we only see it from Athena's perspective. We don't get anything from May until the end. And even then that's framed from Athena's perspective. And we don't even get a scene about it from Michael's perspective. Right. And I get that May isn't a POV character yet, but like we could have mm-hmm. at least had something from her to make this a more
we
of a balanced
seen
portrayal.
The conversation between Michael and May, maybe.
Yeah, that would have been better. I mean, Michael is still main cast at this point. Let no one forget.
Supposedly, yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I have my own problems with the resolution of this, even, but we'll mm-hmm. get there. Whatever. Athena feels like the enemy. She's feeling attacked right now.
Are we
but
the
we
baddies?
Go to Chimney, but we go to Chimney and Hen at Chim's apartment. They're, you know, having a little bestie unwinding time.
Love to
and
see it.
And Hen says that, Hen's kind of catching him up on what's going on with her and Karen. She says that Karen, like, immediately started supporting Hen after the accident, kind of put aside whatever turmoil she was going through previously, and quote, "It's like the IVF stuff never happened." And I must say, that kind of makes it feel like they only did this, like, car crash storyline because they couldn't figure out how to resolve the IVF storyline
a little bit.
So it's just like, oh, Karen's depressed, well, let's have some crazy shit happen to Hen, and then Karen's gonna have to stop being depressed so that she can support Hen. But it's like, and we do get a little more resolution, like acknowledging both of their stuff by the end of the episode, but that line really did feel a little like, oh, like, so this was just kind of a lazy, like,
right.
Well, attempt to get this storyline to move forward when you couldn't
probably
think of a good way to resolve it anyway.
They gave it, like, the resolution, no material consequences for Hen, like, in the long run, right? Like, no actual, like, professional mm-hmm. consequences is because they needed to wrap this up in an episode. You know what I mean? Or at least they felt like they had to. God knows why.
And
it does feel kind of lazy.
Saying this show wraps things up too quickly. They could have stretched this out longer.
Yeah, but I do appreciate one little bit of framing here, like in this sort of new situation Karen and Hen are in, where Hen says that, you know, Karen at her work is a project manager. She's a project lead on all of her, in all of her teams. And so now Hen is like her new project. And that's giving Karen a sense of purpose. And so from that perspective, you do kind of get it that maybe she's like using taking care of Hen as a way to cope with her own grief.
Yeah.
But we do just hear about it. We don't... We don't come to that conclusion ourselves, you know. But it all
basically
culminates...
Karen wants to take Hen to a healing spa, like retreat kind of place. It sounds kind of new agey, but you know, Hen is willing to try it. And Chimney ends up repeating Hen's own wisdom from a while back to her, that, you know, the world is full of patients, but needs more caregivers. And so he thinks she should take all the time she needs because the world needs her back. So, you know, a cute Hen and Chimney bestie moment.
Okay, about this wellness spa, I just must say, first of all, 2025 brain poisoning. Instantly, I'm like, okay, they're going to the White Lotus. They're going to see death, right? But but also, Chimney, like, he hears New Age, like spa. And, like, this is how you know this is a heterosexual man you're dealing with, because he instantly starts, like, like taking, like, crystals to task. Like... he's just like, oh, that sounds like a very crystally place. And I'm like, you would not survive a day in the gay community, okay? I'm looking at my rose quartz I have on the wall that I bought for, like, healing energy of a very specific variety. And sit down, straight man. Gays are talking.
Oh, you're a crystal guy?
Just a little bit. Just you know, just I like to get a little spiritual with it. I like a scented candle. I like a crystal moment. I like a little meditation. What can I say?
Well, I don't know if a scented candle is inherently spiritual.
Hey, it's centering. It's grounding. It aids in the process.
It's especially centering. Especially when
it's like, it's rosewood. What?
You know, scent, like a smell. It's centering.
I didn't hear the T. I thought I didn't get a little bit of funny wordplay. On the pod,
yeah,
yes.
I can't speak too much. My old roommates were crystal people, so I don't want to offend the crystal community. I just kind of think that that's bullshit. But then we go to the dispatch, where Josh is, like, talking to some guy. It's not Terry. It's another guy we see at the dispatch occasionally. I don't remember if he even has a name, but he is a guy who works at the dispatch. And at first I thought they were, like, planning a little date, but they're not. They are planning, like, a group post-work coworker hangout for karaoke. Josh comes over to Maddie and he's like, hey, do you want to go to karaoke with us later? And she says no. She's like, you don't want to hear Buck sing Eye of the Tiger. And I was like, yes, I do.
Yes,
girl.
I do. Are you kidding me?
I would kill to see them humiliate Oliver Stark like that.
Oh my god. You know, he would be like behind the scenes, you would just see him the most miserable he's ever been in his entire life.
He would adopt like a fourth dog just to get through the misery, the anxiety. But it's his one vice.
It's his one vice is dog rescue.
Using dog rescue, like, I need to get my next fix of rescuing a dog. But Maddie gets a call from Tara, which is a surprise because obviously Tara kind of cut ties with her a couple episodes previously. But Tara calls her distraught. She's like sobbing on the phone. She's saying, Maddie, you were right. So Maddie rushes over to Tara's house. Tara answers the door. She's injured. She's kind of beat up and she is holding a gun.
Yeah.
And she's like, Maddie, I shot my husband. I shot Vincent.
I killed him, but he's still alive. And he is still alive. She got him like right in like the area, like the pectoral area or whatever.
In the shoulder, chest kind of.
And like you're watching him bleed out and you're like seeing the damage he did to Tara and you're like, just let him die, girl. Just let him die. It's fine. But Maddie, obviously, that's not her arc. Like, she doesn't let him die.
Maddie has a very complicated relationship to this because, of course, she did kill Doug in self-defense. So she kind of knows both. But now she's experiencing this thing of not regretting killing Doug, but as she expresses in this scene, she, like, wishes that she didn't have to kill Doug.
It's like regretting having to kill him.
It's not just this unambiguous...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not this unambiguous, like, I killed the bad guy and that's good. It's like, as she says, like, I killed someone I used to love. Like, I'll never be free of that.
Yeah.
Like, of course, she has complex emotions about it. And she is a good person and she didn't want to have to kill someone, although she has technically done it twice.
The body count.
The body count. But no, she is feeling complicated about this. And also, like, she's a first responder, essentially. So she also has this impulse immediately to rescue this guy, even if she knows he's a bad guy. It's like she's not just gonna become a vigilante about it.
Yeah, so it goes back to that thing of like, we don't choose who we save, etc., etc.
Yeah, she tries to call 911, but Tara really doesn't want her to, so she starts just like administering first aid. She grabs like a knife and some rubbing alcohol, starts doing an emergency thoracostomy, is like, you're like, how does Maddie, I know she was a nurse, but like, do nurses know how to do thoracostomies? It's Maddie.
It's
She's an incredible nurse, incredible dispatcher. She just does it like it's nothing. And this is when she expresses all these things of like, I'm not free, you know, I'm not. Tara's trying to tell her like, but you killed him, you're free. And she's like, no, I'm not, like, whatever.
Yeah, this
isn't, you know, a light thing to do.
So, yeah, so she slices him open and she sticks her finger in his hole. And then she calls 911. She's like very like on it, like, no, we're calling 911. We're doing it. He's breathing again. We're doing it. Everything gets worse for you if he dies. So we're calling 911. And then when she does, she self-identifies. Did you catch this? She self-identifies as Maddie Kendall.
I did not catch that, but that's very interesting.
It goes completely unmentioned in the episode, and she does it twice. She self-identifies as Maddie Kendall. I didn't think that that was still legally her name, especially because don't people call her Maddie
Buckley?
Maybe it
was a subtle, maybe it was actually a genius subtle thing to show that she's feeling tethered to her accident with Doug in this episode. If so, genius. If not intentional, not genius.
Well, to be honest, I don't think it's genius either way, because I thought that's where they were going with it, and I was like, oh, that's really cool. But then later on, you know, we see a scene of her at the hospital, and the doctor comes up and says Miss Kendall to her right in front of Buck, and no one says anything, and it's never mentioned, and there's no even reaction to it.
So they just forgore.
I think they forgore, guys. And she gives all the details, right? She's like, yeah, there's a gun here. This guy's dying. Just be alert. And the cops roll up. Gotta say, the guy cop that rolls up, it's the thing. He's hot, okay? It's frustrating. The guy cop is hot.
We've seen him before. Yeah, it's one of the recurring cops on this show. And yeah, I guess objectively he is hot, which again could be the intentional propaganda on
again
the part of this show.
Yeah.
But yeah, the EMTs take Vincent away, and Maddie sees Tara like consoling Vincent. So she's already a little bit like, oh man, like is the cycle just going to continue? But
spoiler
to cut
alert,
away to something
yes.
a little less intense, Karen and Hen are arriving at the TLC spa.
The White Lotus, they're checking in. Right.
Someone approaches Hen, and it's Stacy, the life coach that Hen saved in Hen Begins, which prompted her entire first responder career. Shout out Hen Begins.
Let us call to attention the fact that Hen Begins happened last season, and this is the second reference to it in the main, like, continuity of the show.
The writers of season 3 really liked Hen Begins as an episode. And so Stacy is very happy to see Hen. She clearly has all this gratitude for her. She's like, please, like, let me buy you dinner tonight. And Hen and Karen are like, oh, like, you know, we'll get settled and maybe we'll call you, whatever. As they're arriving in their room, we're hearing that Hen's still feeling very disillusioned by the accident. Karen wants to accept Stacy's invitation to dinner and, like, you know, thinks maybe it'll be good for Hen. But Hen is really still feeling all this guilt. She says that she doesn't remember pushing the button to change the light, despite the report saying that she did.
Yeah.
And so she's saying that, like, she doesn't feel she can trust herself and her instincts anymore.
Again, would have been more interesting if they gave her material consequences for the crash, but whatever, it's fine, we covered that. And Karen makes a really good point, actually, where you know, she talks about how it's muscle memory, and she actually should trust her instincts because it was such like a non-thought in her head to do that, that it was such an automatic response that it's just baked into what she does. Like, her being a good, diligent first responder is so baked into her process that she doesn't even register anymore, in the same way that Karen doesn't remember brushing her teeth this morning, even though she knows that she did, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's definitely a point in there, definitely a point that Karen is making. However, there's one thing that was completely haunting this scene and the last one for me. And I don't know if it was just like a strange kind of misguided choice on the part of Stacey's actress. I don't know her actress. I don't know if she's in other stuff. She's in Hen Begins, and she gave a very normal performance in that. Very capable, normal performance. But in this episode, I was getting, like, Jonestown. I was getting Heaven's Gate. Just with the way that she delivered things, just with the sort of, like, the breathy, like, bright-eyed, like, unblinking way in which she delivered her lines.
Yeah, she was very, like, smiley and serene and in a way. I mean,
I get it's a wellness spa, but,
grateful,
like,
grateful that her life was saved.
But, like, then they go to dinner with her later on, and, like, she's doing it the whole scene, and you really notice it. And then they just leave, and, like, you never find out what the deal with the fucking wellness spa was. And I'm like, is this a cult? Did they just stumble into, like, a California cult?
Maybe she's just really relaxed, okay? She's been in the hot tub all day. She's been in the sauna all day. She's been, like, getting the hot rocks on her back. She's been getting massaged. She's been listening to those affirmations that the meteor girl was listening to.
The comet will come, and behind it is a spaceship. And we will, on the day of its arrival, we will transport our souls up into the spaceship and live for eternity. Ooh,
okay,
yes.
On, like, a much meaner show, it would have been so funny if, like, when they're having dinner and, like, she's just given Hen back her will to live by being like, yeah, you made sure that I could be there for the birth of my grandchildren and, you know, see my daughter get married. And then, like, she tries to initiate them into a cult right after. It turns out it was all just a ploy to get Hen and Karen in her cult.
I mean, they are lesbians. It could be a Yellow Jacket era, you know? It could be like a Yellow Jackets arc where... By the way, I just want to say, I fell off of Yellow Jackets so hard in season 3 because I felt like it got bad and aimless, and so I haven't been keeping up with it. But if any of our viewers, like our listeners, are fans of Yellow Jackets, can you just, like, leave a comment telling me where the show goes and if I should keep watching it?
Just a comment full of spoilers for a show this podcast isn't about.
Please, just a call to action. This is my Hail Mary, because everyone I've spoken to who watches it in my life, like, they all say the same thing, which is like, yeah, it's gotten bad, but I'm in too deep and I'm too not normal about it to back out now. This is the sunk cost fallacy at work. And I'm like, great. Because the first season of Yellow Jackets is genuinely an amazing, amazing, amazing piece of television. And I think the second season was also pretty good. What happened?
Well, I haven't watched it. So back at the hospital, Buck and Maddie are in the hospital waiting room. Buck is, like, talking about how Maddie's emergency first aid was totally badass. But Maddie is not in as peppy a mood.
No.
Buck's kind of not reading the room.
No, he's not.
But Maddie, the hot cop, walks back in, and Maddie hears from him that Vincent is actually not pressing charges. He's telling the police that he shot himself by accident. That's the story that Vincent and Tara are telling the cops. Maddie kind of expresses disbelief, and the cop's like, yeah, I don't really buy it either, but, like, that's all we can do about it. So yeah. Tara comes out to thank Maddie, and she says that Vincent told her he could forgive her, you know, if she can forgive him.
Ugh.
And that they're kind of doing a fresh start and it'll be different this time. So Maddie realizes that Tara is not ready to accept help, and perhaps will never be. She realizes that she's helped her as much as she can and she can't help her anymore.
Yeah, I'm kind of two minds of this. Well, actually, I'm not even, because I'm like, I'm really kind of struggling with this sort of, like, storyline resolution here, because, like, it's very clear that Tara is a battered woman and the cycle is just going to continue with them. This is, you know, classic case of, like, abusive climax, love bombing, and then the cycle just continues. It's all part of it. And, like, I understand, like, sort of the narrative beat. And it is interesting to have Maddie say, this woman is beyond the scope of my help. But then she kind of lets Tara go, and it's like, no, I mean, Maddie, like, if you don't keep tabs on her, this woman's going to wind up, like, you know, in the same situation or worse, and, you know, no one here wants that. So, I don't know, like, I kind of needed, like, one more... they're so in deep with this storyline, and so much has happened in it that, like, I feel like it can't really end on this note saying this woman, you know, isn't ready to accept help, so I'm just going to take my hands off and let her be abused until she is. That feels...
I think it's maybe more that, you know, Maddie, she was doing this really overstepping thing where she was stalking Tara, and now... Tara continues to refuse her help, and so, you know, it's kind of two things where it's like, on the one hand, yes, I think it's healthy for Maddie to accept that she can't keep trying to force Tara to understand something that she clearly doesn't yet, mm-hmm. and also, yeah, it'd be nice to see some follow-up or Maddie being like, you know, take this card if you ever need help or something or whatever.
Like, give her, like, even just refer to like some sort of service, like a battered woman's shelter or even like a counselor or something like that. Just something other than just completely taking your hands off the wheel. Because we are,
just in case this is a thing, just in case this is a thing, I'm not sure battered woman is still that much of an in-use term.
Oh, is it not?
You know. It just has sort of a raw and unwieldy vibe to me. I'm just gonna clarify. Shelter for survivors of domestic abuse. I don't know.
Yeah.
You can cut that out if you want. I just keep hearing battered woman, and I feel like it's from like the 70s or something.
Let me. I'm actually gonna Google this.
I'm not saying it's like super super. Frowned upon. I just feel like it's sort of a passe way to put it.
Okay, so no, you are right. It seems that the term has been criticized by some survivor advocates as being outdated terminology, not used outside of courts. The newer term used among advocates and outside of the courts is criminalized survivor. What? Mm. Wait. That feels way more nondescript and also ambiguous. What?
Okay, well, maybe even just like abused woman is a little less harsh than...
How about a shelter for survivors of domestic violence? How about that?
Yeah, it's not that... Yeah, there's just something about battered women that sounds like sort of like what a sort of mustached judge would say about survivors of domestic violence in like the 70s. That's the vibe I'm getting for some reason.
No, that's totally true. I mean, it does feel like sort of like a character on LA Law would say that in like a scene where they're all smoking cigars.
You know, stuffy male cop shows up and he's like, looks like it's another battered woman.
Yeah, a little it does feel a little swashbuckling. So no, you're right about that. I'm probably gonna leave that in because it's a good conversation to have.
It's a good conversation. It's a learning experience, little teachable moment.
This terminology is always in flux, and it's important to err on the side of caution when talking about sensitive subjects. So
it's tough because like, you know, we're totally unscripted on this podcast, and so sometimes if you like just say the first word that comes to mind or whatever, sometimes like we've had before like little gaffes like that, so I wanted to clarify because in my mind I had like a little inkling of like, I'm not sure people say that anymore, and mm-hmm. I don't want somebody to like anyone to not like that,
to be made to feel uncomfortable because of it. No, that's definitely true.
Yeah,
I mean, like, you know, these are unscripted, and so it's I think it's good when moments like that happen because it is a learning opportunity. And you know, I like, it's a good reminder that semantics are important. So that is a good note for the future. This storyline wraps up bad because Maddie didn't give her a card for a shelter for domestic survivors.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like it would have been nice if there was, or I guess from what I remember, we never get like a follow up of like what became of Tara, and so in retrospect, it does feel a little like dark that this is just where we leave her.
Yeah.
I do think it's good drama, like, and it is like a realistic scenario, so I think this part of the story is kind of satisfying in that way, but it's not like, yeah, it's too bad that we never follow up.
Yeah, but instead we get a very different, jarring, hard right turn of a follow-up to a different storyline.
Oh boy, yes. Yes. This was
life comes at you fast.
This was the second time in the episode. This was the second time in the episode that I said, "Oh, it's that episode."
Yeah.
Because we go to Buck's loft, and Eddie and Buck are talking, and Buck's in that tight, unflattering little hoodie, and you're like, "Oh, I've seen this scene in edit after edit after edit," and they're having a couple beers. Because they're boys.
Because they're boys. Okay. This is what boys do when they're having some fun. Just a boys' night. I did write in my notes, in all caps, buddy maxing, 2 question marks. Now, 5 question marks.
I know. It almost feels like tasteless.
Yeah.
But they are talking. They're gossiping, really. Mm-hmm. Talking about the Maddie situation. And Buck says Maddie realized that you can't save someone from themselves if they don't want it. And he says, especially if you aren't around to see that they need saving. And so, you know, we realize that he's talking about the situation between him and Eddie. And he apologizes for not being there during the lawsuit. He says, I should have been there, which is a normal thing to say to your platonic bestie. And he's like, maybe I could have talked some sense into you during this whole Fight Club arc you were having if I had been around noticing what was going on with you. And Eddie says, you know, things got a little out of hand for both of us. Don't beat yourself up about it. At which point Buck says, why? Because you'd rather do it. Which already, it feels, first of all, very, like, yeah, sexually tense in the way that scenes are when somebody's like, shut up, and the other person's like, make me. You know, it has, yeah, that vibe.
It's like when, it's like, it's pure, like, you know, you're wrestling, and then, like, there's that pause as, like, your lips are close together. What person's on top?
But also, it almost feels like this sort of metaphor about, like, this metaphor for Eddie's entire gay repression thing of, like, oh, you're throwing punches over here. Because it's sort of like that classic, you know, you touch the skin of, you construct intricate rituals to touch the skin of other men. It's like you're doing all this shit because you have, I forget the name of the artist who made that poster, but it's like you're doing all this because where you'd rather be focusing your physical and emotional energy is on your beautiful best friend. But whatever. The guise of the scene is that they're talking about fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And Eddie says, you're going to make it about you again, which this is a sentiment that Eddie brings up about Buck all the time that I never really think is justified, but whatever. It's what the show has decided on, so whatever. Buck says, I'm just saying, you were pretty pissed. I thought for sure that day in the grocery store you were going to take a swing at me. To which Eddie responds, not that you didn't deserve it, but I wouldn't do that. You're on blood thinners. So, you know, turning it into kind of a teasing, mm-hmm, challenging
it's exchange. The tension Buck is says, growing. Yeah, yeah.
It's growing. And Buck has maybe the craziest line of the scene. Like, I know we all talk about the you want to go for the title line, mm-hmm, but I feel like this is the most homoerotic line. He says, I'd still take you, while bringing the phallic object of the beer bottle, yeah, to his lips, like really
so
putting it in his mouth, like he wants to take a bite
out
of it. I'm
so glad you pointed that out, because
it's very integral to the scene.
After Buck then follows that up with, you know, by the way, going for his waistline, right?
Right. He grabs his belt like he's about to whip it out.
He goes, you want to go for the title? And Eddie brings his beer to his mouth. The phallus.
I wish I could resurrect Freud from the grave and show him this scene and be like, do you think this is sexual at all? Just to hear what he would say, and then I would put him back in his grave.
It's like, oh my god, what do you even make of this? I mean, it's Oliver Stark going on that podcast, cut to him going,
to quote,
yeah, that
Oliver
was
Oliver Stark himself, that was super gay.
That was super gay. Okay, and then
now, does that remark ring a little more sore now that we have gotten through season 8 and Buddy Cannon still didn't happen? Sure. But it's like, for the record, we have that, you know, we'll always have that. He did admit it, you know, he was at the scene of the crime. And he admitted it.
Is Buddy going canon, or are we all just jerking off? No, they're jerking off each other in this scene.
Each other. Okay. Oh my god.
Like, and then it cuts to, of course, the where they're actually going to go for the title. They have their son in between them, and they're all playing. Okay, they're playing a video game, and it's in like a style similar to like Marvel vs. Capcom or whatever. It's actually, and I was doing some Googling. It's actually an alpha build of a game called Cerebral that seems to have never been released.
Well, yeah, I was watching and I thought that looks kind of shitty. It looks like maybe like they just did like a mock-up of like a fake video game so that they wouldn't have to deal with copyright or anything.
It seems
to be styled kind of like a Street Fighter kind of thing.
Yeah, so you saying that is so embarrassing on the part of the team that made this, because it was intended in earnest to be a real product by like an indie game.
My apologies to the makers of whatever video game you just said.
I was looking into it. Apparently Cerebral was developed by a team of 6 people in Seattle, and they got pretty far along in their alpha build. They were opening it for beta testing. You can buy it. You can still buy it. It's available for purchase for, I think, $18 on their website. But it never made it out of beta, and it has not seen an official release on any platform. I don't even think on Steam. There is no Wikipedia page for the project. There's no Wikipedia page for the team. So it seems to be just an abandoned project that, given that the team dissolved in 2020, seems to be a COVID casualty. So, 2020
is... So how did the makers of 911 get their hands on it?
I guess it was cheap and licensing wasn't even a big deal because it's an alpha build of an indie game that could use the PR. I mean, like, would we know what Cerebral was if not for this show? Probably not.
Exactly. I was about to say, hey, creators of Cerebral, if you're listening, developers, take solace in the fact, that your work will live on forever in one of the most loved gay scenes on 911.
And if you are listening, come on the pod.
Yeah, we'd love to speak to you. Oh, and at the end of this scene, Eddie says, "This is my kind of therapy." And it's like, honey, you gotta go to real therapy too. Yeah.
But they settled it in Smash. And it's fine.
Men will literally fuck each other through video games instead of going to therapy.
Okay. Years and years and a lifetime of experience has told me that this is unambiguously true. You just spat absolute fire.
No, like it is realistic.
It is so realistic, okay? So this is honestly a very...
That could be like its own psychological theory, I feel like.
This is a very truthful...
You construct intricate video game rituals.
Of the male
instead
psyche.
Instead of touching the skin of other men.
Yeah, but we hard cut from...
Oh my god, we have to call this episode Intricate Video Game Rituals.
Please. But we hard cut from the Intricate Video Game Ritual to dinner with Stacy. They took Stacy up on her offer to buy them dinner as a way of saying thank you to Hen for saving her life and allowing her to find the good word of Jim Jones or whatever the fuck.
Right, of course Stacy is secretly plotting to get Karen and Hen into her cult.
Okay, this is what
she doesn't mention it.
No, this is where I thought was happening was because Hen says it was serendipity that this happened. And then in this scene, Karen says it was serendipity that it happened. And then in this scene, Stacy literally says it was serendipity. I'm like, is this cult all about serendipity? Yo, what is going on? It doesn't go that route.
The cult is called serendipity.
She's just kind of cray, I'm not going to lie. Stacy is
Stacy talks about how she got to see all of these things, like her daughter getting married, her grandchildren being born, and all of that is ultimately because of Hen. You know, she's so grateful every day for her life. She's grateful to God, and she's grateful to Hen most of all.
Okay,
so the implication could be that Hen is God.
Okay, but I have to ask, does she mean she sees these things literally? Does she mean she literally saw these things in her... Okay, that didn't...
She's saying she got to see those things because she lived, because she didn't die of her heart attack.
Okay, that didn't click for me, because the way this was prompted was by Karen asking her, when she had her near-death experience, did she see a light? Did she see God? And she goes, no, I didn't see God, but I've seen other things. I saw...
Yeah, that does come off a little
my,
creepy.
My daughter's wedding. I saw the birth of my grandchildren. And I thought she was, like, doing it like a reality shifter. Like, I thought she was saying, like, I've experienced visions because I have found a sort of shroomy oneness or something. And so that, like, just fully did not click for me that she was talking completely literally, like, oh, these are the life events, because of the way that it was presented. Maybe I was so far up my own ass as well, because of the cult shit.
Yeah.
But it, either way, I just think... And also, I will say, that's also what the performance was giving. Okay, I need to repeat this.
Yeah.
This is a very shroomy performance. Okay, this is a very, like, I saw the Eye of Horus, and, you know, I've become one with the natural, you know, like, wavelengths of the universe or something. That's what this performance is giving me. But the point is, Hen saved her life.
That Hen saved her life, and hearing all of this from Stacy kind of gives Hen some purpose back and reminds her how good a first responder she is and that she has value in this world, you know. Mm-hmm. Elsewhere, a truck is pulling up to the gas station.
Guys,
a real life truck.
This might be the realest, lifest truck we've seen on this show so far.
Because this truck is full of nuclear waste.
And uh-oh, the minute you see that radioactive thing on one of the barrels, you just know it's gonna go boom. They're bringing a dirty bomb into downtown LA. It's happening.
Yes, we've got like an older truck driver named Ernest and a younger truck driver, and they are driving together. Ernest's like giving him some wisdom.
Some very earnest wisdom, I will say.
Yes, so true. He goes to check on the cargo and sees that there are these drums in the back of the truck labeled like radioactive. He realizes that they're transporting something kind of illicit that they weren't supposed to be transporting. And he tells the younger guy, once he's back in the cab, he's like, yeah, the company's been cutting a lot of corners lately. And suddenly, as they're driving through a tunnel, they... like don't see that there's like construction
somehow
blocking the road. There's
a
poor construction guy like waving his arms in front of the truck like, hey, stop. And they have not seen this until the last second. So Ernest swerves, they end up crashing, but it doesn't seem like too bad of a crash. Then another truck crashes into the back of their truck, rear ends them, causing a small explosion, and the contents of the truck light on fire.
Yeah. And the fire,
so that's not good.
And the fire is white. Guys, we are dealing with hazardous materials.
The fire is white, scary
chemical fire. Maddie gets the call and dispatches the 118. And instantly, okay, so at first, you know, they show up and like, okay, so we know that there's radioactive material in there. They don't know what chemical it is. They put on their, you know, protective gear, whatever, their masks, everything, just taking general caution. And they take a look at the fire. It's burning white. It looks, I think Chimney identifies it as magnesium. Now, for those...
I think Eddie identifies it as magnesium.
Right. Okay, so Eddie knows what
They've
magnesium fires look like.
They've positioned him in this sequence as, like, knowing a lot about radioactive materials.
I guess he just
knows chemistry. You could say that he knows some things from his time in the army, mm-hmm. but I think it's kind of funny that he's the guy in this scene being like, oh yeah, man, that's cobalt 60. Once those drums get burnt, this entire tunnel is gonna turn into Chernobyl.
But it's interesting the way that they build the tension here, because okay, so magnesium, so when magnesium burns, it gives off alpha radiation. That's what it emits, and alpha radiation is very low penetrating power, so the biggest danger posed is by either ingestion or through open wounds like the truck driver has. He has bad leg injury. Hmm. But other than that, it's easily stopped by like clothing, and it doesn't penetrate the skin very well. So you're not really in a lot of danger of like acute radiation syndrome, right?
Right.
But then the guy reveals, oh no, it's not just alpha radiation there. It's fucking cobalt 60, fucking like nuclear byproduct cobalt 60 that gives off fucking gamma rays. The thing that turned Bruce Banner into the Hulk. They're gonna die, okay? They're all gonna die.
Yeah.
It is
Bobby
harrowing.
Has a great line when he hears this, and he says, "You were transporting radioactive waste through the middle of downtown Los Angeles." I just think that's a great campy line.
It reminds me of like Batman v Superman, like when they're like looking for like the white Portuguese, where they're trying to bring a dirty bomb into Gotham. It's like, oh wow, we need Batman on this case.
Well, that leads to Eddie having my favorite Eddie line of the episode, which is, "That magnesium's gonna burn through those drums. Once that happens, this entire tunnel is gonna turn into Chernobyl." I just think, like, that's such a ridiculous line to give Eddie, give anyone on the show, but I love especially that it's Eddie.
It's so...
like, the drama of that.
It's so melodramatic. It's so intense. And, like, it's also, like, totally true is a thing. Like, if... if that
it's not, like, melodramatic
goes,
as
boom.
In, like, he's overreacting. It's just melodramatic that this is what the show is doing.
I know, right? It's like one of these scenarios that it's like, wow, this is network TV, huh?
Yeah. But Bobby tells Buck and Eddie to leave the tunnel, that mm-hmm. he'll stay with Ernest. He's like, "I need you guys to get the liquid nitrogen," because the other thing is that their water is not working on the fire. Like, the magnesium fire is like reactive to water, mm-hmm. so their hoses aren't doing anything. So instead, they have to call in for liquid nitrogen, which mm-hmm. will put out this fire.
Yeah.
So they've done that. He's like, "Buck, Eddie, go get the liquid nitrogen. I'll stay with Ernest." They get out to check on Chimney, and they hear that the nitro is delayed because of, like, traffic. Traffic, right?
Downtown
the
LA.
Silent killer.
You know? If I was like the fucking liquid nitro truck, and like the only thing standing between me and like a dirty bomb that's going to irradiate like the entirety of like the LA metropolitan area was like a traffic jam, I would start like plowing through cars left and right. Are you kidding? No one is safe because everyone is going to die if I don't get there. And I would be so pissed too. I would be like angrily doing it too, like very righteous in like, honestly, I would find joy in it. I would find joy in pushing through.
I believe you that
truck.
You would. But at this point, Bobby tells Buck and Eddie, like, not to come back in because the cobalt has now ignited. He says, "We're at gamma radiation level." I was kind of like, how does he know that? Like, you just explained all this stuff about radiation, so I guess you know this stuff, but I didn't. I wouldn't, if somebody tells me the cobalt 60 is on fire and then asks me what radiation level are we at, I would be like, you are asking the wrong person.
Maybe this is what not going to college does for you, you know? Maybe this is what...
Right. I mean, I guess it's true that maybe this was like a part of his training at some point in case there's ever a hazardous materials fire. It seems like a little specific, but what do I know? Maybe it's normal for him to know that, but it feels like an oddly specific thing for him to know.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby decides to use some of his CO2 to put out the fire, but that doesn't go a long way. He only has a little bit of it. Finally, the nitrogen is here. Buck starts pumping it onto the fire, utilizing his phallic fire hose, except this time it's liquid nitrogen. So, like, what does that symbolize? It's like a different, more potent version of his phallic symbol, which could mean nothing, I guess.
I guess, you know, he's really going for the title with this, but they put it out, thank God, and now we have to deal with the literal fallout. This episode is called Fallout, and so far we've only been dealing with emotional fallout, right? But now there's literal nuclear fallout to deal with.
Radiation fallout, yeah.
And
so the hazmat workers get in, they get Bobby and Ernest out of the tunnel, mm-hmm. you know, the fire gets extinguished. Eddie says the fallout's gonna be minimal. Title drop. Chim says maybe not for all of us, and then looks significantly at Bobby. Chobby moment. Bobby is having his clothes and belongings like stripped and cleaned. He gets in the radiation shower. He gets in his turnouts, which I thought was odd. Like, wouldn't it make more sense for him to take them off?
Well, I get that
you can't just show Bobby naked on camera, but like chest up, maybe?
No, they have to decontaminate the turnouts as well, because those are also radioactive.
But like, why not do that separately? I don't know.
I don't know. I'm not a scientist, so I can't provide a detailed explanation. We'll have to get like, I don't know.
I guess I'm just saying, for the purpose of realism, I think Bobby should have been fully butt naked in this scene.
That would have been great. That would have been realism. And honestly, I want to see his bare ass on my television. So,
yeah, like
missed
it's
opportunity.
A double purpose.
missed opportunity number four of this episode, question mark.
Then we go to
because he gets his decontamination shower, and then we go to him in the hospital, and the enemy is in there with him for his results.
Yes, his wife, the enemy. Athena and Bobby are at the hospital. The doctor comes in. They've been running a battery of tests. Everything looks okay. His urine test showed a little bit of elevated cobalt, but like he's not looking like he's in immediate danger. And they tell him they can discharge him soon, but they're going to have to run this battery of tests every week for the next 6 weeks. And then we get kind of an unfortunate in hindsight moment to end the scene where Athena says, "I am not ready to be a widow."
Ooh, and you're like, "Oof, girl, no, you're going to eat those words."
And then she literally says to him, she says, "You will not get sick on me." And at that point, I was like, this is actually kind of insane. This is like so crazy.
Well, can we take a moment to appreciate how remarkable it is that Bobby didn't die of this, right? Instead, like maybe he like got like long-term complications and then cancer happened and then he died of that mm-hmm. would have at least been a callback, right, as opposed to, you know, super virus. And I just have to ask this, maybe I'm gonna do the show's homework for it for a second. maybe this
was all a long game.
No, maybe the cobalt 60 is what killed Bobby's miracle blood and that's why we never heard about it again. Why it had
and then
no consequence.
In turn, it made his blood weaker, meaning that he was more susceptible to the Crimean Congo fever, and that's why he died.
Right That makes sense. I can respect
it's all
that. It's all connected. So we cut away from that with Athena very powerfully going, "You're not gonna die on me." Sure,
it's like,
Jan.
Sorry, girl. We go to Hen and Karen
escaping Jonestown.
Oh my god. it's like you know, Athena's like, "You will not get sick on me," and then Tim Minear texting her at 3 a.m. saying, "OMG, you're gonna hate me."
But no, Hen and Karen escape Jonestown, and they get back home, and you know that. And
they do say there was a lot of traffic on the way. Maybe it was the same traffic the nitrogen truck ran into.
That would be funny. They're talking, and you know, sort of Karen's talking about sort of this process of taking care of Hen, and as she's like talking about it, you kind of understand that maybe this trip, this wellness trip, is more for Karen than it was for Hen, because it doesn't seem to have done a whole lot for Hen, but it does seem to have done a hell of a lot for Karen in her mood.
Well, you know, sometimes that's what you do when you're like, "Oh yeah, it's kind of like when you get a gift for someone, but it's secretly like a gift for yourself." Yeah. She was like, "Yeah, let's go to this rest and relaxation retreat that I've been, you know, meaning to go to for like 10 years. It'll be great for you."
The dad that buys his kid an Xbox so he can play it.
But actually, what Hen is expressing in this scene is she feels the opposite. She's like not sure if Karen has gotten enough out of this trip. Mm-hmm. You know, she feels like it was kind of all about her. But, you know, Karen says she doesn't feel like she got shortchanged. She is really taking what Stacy said to heart about living in the moment and feeling grateful for everything. She says she's feeling grateful for Hen and Denny. And Hen's like, "You know, you had me worried for a minute there when you were so depressed that, like, maybe me and Denny weren't enough." But Karen says actually the source of her anguish was she was worried she wasn't good enough for them because she couldn't kind of give them more children. And Hen really reassures her. She's like, "I don't care how many kids we have, just that we have them together." Aww. Very beautiful sentiment.
They're in love, Your Honor.
But before they can have some beautiful lesbian sex, Denny comes in, interrupts them, says he's done unpacking, asks if they can go pick up Paisley now.
So Paisley mentioned.
She is still around. She's not on screen. Mm-hmm. I guess they couldn't afford to pay the dog wrangler any longer than in season two.
And then they ask him, "Did you actually unpack, or are all your clothes just on your bed unfolded?" And he goes, "You only said unpack." And he's like the master technicalities now. He's a master. So like one like 3 days with Karen's dad or whatever, and he's already picking up on like the master of technicalities right? great influence. I love Jenny. Because like I was wondering
about that line. She says like 3 days with Uncle Trey or whatever, and mm-hmm. and he's already master of technicalities. So I was like, what's the lore there? Is Uncle Trey like a lawyer?
Maybe
perhaps.
Maybe we would know more about Karen's family if Karen got more screen time. But
if Karen was a character with attention put towards her. But yeah, that's about the end of that. They decide they'll go pick up Paisley. Mm-hmm. Then we get Athena and Bobby arriving home. May, Harry, and Michael are there. So, uh-oh, it's time for our May-Athena confrontation. May says she's worried because she heard the truck driver involved in the nuclear waste accident could have cancer. Like, that's what they're saying on the news. So she's worried that the same could be true for Bobby. But Bobby tries to reassure her, like, no, I'm feeling fine. You know, my tests were fine. So Michael starts talking about how there are going to be repercussions for the company that owned this truck and was like transporting this waste, about how they're probably going to get like super investigated, and that the company itself is probably going to make Ernest's life a living hell for being mm-hmm. a whistleblower, because now he's like going to the media about this. And May says that she thinks he's brave for telling the truth and standing up for what's right, prompting Athena to like look at her angrily.
Oh my god, May is going to be like so like May is so in deep like in the hole with this college admissions essay. She's gonna turn Athena against environmentalists. She's gonna turn Athena literally against the concept of whistleblowing. Which I don't know, maybe that's
Athena
in line
like
with her character.
Full radicalization pipeline.
This is the alt-right
She's
pipeline.
Like, my daughter was a little too annoying about being anti-cop, and now I don't believe in women having the right to vote.
In a year, she's doing a podcast with like Marjorie Taylor Greene or like Candace Owens or something.
She goes on Joe Rogan to be like, yeah, I just don't think we need all of this waste in, you know, the way the government works.
Oh, no.
I think we should really cut out some of the fat.
She gets a job at the Department of Government Efficiency. We need to stop.
No, if Angela Bassett ever finds this podcast,
no.
We love and respect you.
We love and respect you, Angela, and all the great work that you do.
Come on the pod.
But we need to appreciate how crazy of a choice it is that for Athena's entire storyline this episode, May has been a very central, like the central most player in it. And here at the mm-hmm. end is her first appearance of the episode. That's crazy to me, isn't it? Like, that's just kind of mm-hmm. wild. I don't know.
It very much is, yeah, Athena's little tantrum about it, and we see it all from her perspective. But here, Athena wants to talk to May about the essay, and she apparently has made her peace with it, because what she does is she corrects her on one point. She says, you know, you called me an officer in your essay. I'm actually a sergeant, and, you know, that may not mean much to you, but that's an important distinction in my line of work. But after she says that, and May says, like, you know, I'll fix it, she says she thinks the essay is good to go, and that it's very strong, and the admissions people will be very impressed. Mm-hmm. So it's like, yay, like, Athena worked through it. She
swallowed her pride. It's good.
It.
Yeah.
Right.
She did what she was supposed to do.
But then the little speech she gives May is, I know you're still trying to figure things out. Figure yourself out. You and I might not always agree on the choice the other makes, but I'm very proud of what I do, I'm proud of who I am, and I just hope one day when you're my age that you'll be able to look at your daughter and say the same. So it's like very diplomatic, but I don't really like the implication when she says, like, I know you're still trying to figure things out.
Yeah.
It just always comes off very condescending to me. Like, she doesn't actually believe that there's any merit to her daughter's thoughts and feelings about this. She just thinks, like, I know you're wrong, but you're young and you're still figuring it out. So I'll give you time to be wrong now and you'll learn the truth eventually. Like, what this speech gives me.
It's like the parent who, like, you know, tries to come to terms with, like, their child coming out as gay by telling them, like, I know you're just confused and figuring things out right now. You know, it's like, it does kind of feel like a similar sentiment of, like, you know, I'm not taking your positions or your autonomy seriously. But one right. day, when you have my experience and my wisdom and my perspective,
yeah.
you'll come around to seeing things my way. And I'll, and then maybe right. I'll finally respect you. That does feel kind of...
Literally.
Kind of so, kind of icky.
So that's like my... like you said, I do think it's not as bad as some of the other stuff we've seen this season. But it still always strikes me as not a true concession to May's point of view.
Yeah, which may be frustrating. Like, it is definitely frustrating. But it's also realistically like probably best case scenario
well,
for
yeah,
how
but
Athena
as we've always said, it's
this.
Like just because it's technically realistic doesn't mean like it's a story. It's making deliberate choices. Yeah. But yes, in real life, like, yeah, sometimes you can only get a parent to like come around so much. And if you've like made peace, it's like then sometimes that can be enough.
Yeah.
Like just that you're not fighting anymore or whatever.
It would have sat so, better for Athena, me with, if again, we had just gotten just an ounce of May POV in this entire storyline.
Just if it felt like the show considered her perspective legitimate, which it doesn't really.
Yeah.
But Michael says to her, he's like, that wasn't so bad, huh? And May says she actually kind of wishes Athena had just said she was mad at May because, you know, this is more complex.
Yeah.
And whatever. We go to our ending kind of montage. A song by The National starts playing. And the next day we see Athena sending the kids off to school. We see Eddie sending Chris off to school. And Hen starts narrating with this crazy line. She says, life hits you head on sometimes. Which it's like, Hen, too soon.
Too soon.
Too soon. That felt like rather insensitive phrasing.
It did. And like we see like, you know, like this sort of montage of things from the episode, the sort of the wrap up montage, like a news report about mm-hmm. the whistleblower, like saying like today the real fallout begins, drink.
Yeah, we get a couple different fallout mentions.
Like we get like this the lady from the opening call going on Instagram Live and talking about it. We and also we'll say
she did
in the tradition.
Famous, so good for her. She's leveraging her crazy event that happened to her for clout.
In the
Which
grand
is what you should
tradition
always do when something notable happens to you.
This show's Instagram Lives, you do get some very funny comments from yeah. this. The funniest yeah. to me were one, someone saying, you're a whole new person, whole spelled H-O-L-E, which taken out of context yeah. is just crazy harassment. But also then someone just asking point blank, what was your hospital bill? I genuinely died. Because like I want to know that.
And
that's
I
what
like
I want
to
know.
Too. But she has this great line where she says, I used to have this hole inside me, but after getting an actual hole, I feel whole. Too much mention of hole for my taste, to be quite honest.
I agree. But poetry, poetry. It's good. Poetry. You know, you love to see it. It's
right.
Wordplay.
And sometimes it's meant to make you feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So my other take
you.
On this montage is that this is another instance where I feel like the narration is unnecessary and in fact kind of detracts from
oh, yeah.
the
oh,
like earnestness
yeah.
and you know resonance of the scenes we're seeing. So I'm starting to think maybe 911 is just not a narration kind of show and yeah. maybe they should stop doing this.
No.
I feel like it worked when Abby did yeah. it, perhaps because she was kind of this unique character who yeah. wasn't who was kind of like, I mean, we start with her narration in
yeah.
the very first episode,
she was,
right?
She was
so
positioned as, like, the
more,
narrator of the show. It felt like that.
Yeah, it felt a lot more natural. And also, of course, that episode starts with narration, and then we continue to get narration, versus on most of these more recent episodes, like, they'll just randomly have a character start narrating at the end of the episode instead of having it be a consistent element. So I think it often just becomes very corny, partly because these actors tend to get a lot cornier when they're doing voiceover.
Cut to,
but also
cut
because...
to like, Carrie Bradshaw at her computer being like, and I started to wonder.
I couldn't
if Big,
help but wonder.
If Big could, if Big could make, make room for a meteorite in his esophagus, then why couldn't he make room for me?
Meteor is moving to Paris.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it feels like also the narration tends to just redundantly state the obvious, you mm-hmm. know, like the themes that we have already seen very clearly happen on screen. It'll just be like, sometimes, and sometimes even the theme that is the title of the episode, mm-hmm. it'll just be like, well, sometimes the things in our lives have fallout. And it's like, well, yeah, you didn't need to tell me that.
We got that. We watched the episode, didn't we? Right?
I've seen it. I've seen the episode too. You don't need to remind me.
And it's so not so helped by the fact that, this was just another moment
where,
like,
I was like, cut the narration.
And it's,
cut it.
And it's so not helped by the fact that all of, like, the scripted scenes that accompany the narration are so, like, twee and so fluffy in, like, a way that feels very dissonant from, like, the tone of the rest of the episode. And so it just feels like a, you know, sort of like amateur Tumblr fanfic style wrap up that it just feels, you know, trite, you know, it takes me out of it. And so I don't think I've ever personally been moved by any of these non-Abby narration moments, certainly not in recent memory. It just feels corny. It's corny. But it ends with Hen syncing back up with the 118, of course. And when they go out on a call, Hen says, "I'll drive." Aww.
Well, okay. First of all, there are a couple things we skipped over there. Maddie goes back to therapy, and she actually called him this time. She's, like, finally ready to be receptive to therapy. And she says a really, like, good dramatic line where she says, like, "I need to talk about how I really feel about killing my husband." And she, like, breaks down as she's saying it. And that's, like, a good moment where you're like, ooh, like, I'm excited to see what else is going on there.
Imagine if the episode ended on that and it didn't have narration. Like...
oh, yeah, that would have been way stronger. But then we get a very funny cut to Athena at home on her computer, and she's just Googling radiation poisoning.
Okay, no, Athena is not Googling. They're using a non-brand specific search engine that just says search. And I'm sorry, but is search. Google not enough of a monopoly on search engines that you can just use it in media? Like,
you see it all over the place in movies. The funniest one I've ever seen was in a Lifetime movie. They had a search engine called Gigo Search, which is like, why not? You didn't need to do all that.
No, you didn't. You just, oh my God. Or like went on like, back in like the 2010s, like when they would like just randomly have people using Bing because Microsoft was sponsoring the project.
Because Microsoft paid for, But like you said, finally, you know, we get, Hen is back at the station. She reunites with everybody. They get a call. And yeah, they're about to ship out in the trucks. And Hen says, "Chim, I'll drive." And I'm sorry, but that read as comedic for me.
Yeah.
And I got this image in my head of, like, imagine they leave the station and she just immediately runs over another civilian.
Like, it's like the, like, oh my God, like it's like a fucking Wayans Brother movie or something, and like that's like the fucking
right
ending.
Or like an episode of It's Always Sunny or something. Just like, oh fuck. I did
not
it again.
Not this again. Oops, I did it again. That would have been gold. That would have made the whole thing worth it. But yeah, then the episode ends.
And I started picturing just like a version of 911 that's like a parody of 911.
Ooh.
With that, with like, in our parody of 911, yes, that would have happened. The lady would have actually been trying to initiate Hen and Karen into a cult.
Mm-hmm. This is what Hot Shots should have been, right? This is what Hot Shots could have been.
We should just start writing our parody 911.
We should. We'll write a pilot and we'll send it into Tim. Be like, "Hey, produce us." No, honestly,
it's called 911.
No, so Tim won't like it, but I feel like if we sent it to Ryan Murphy, he might get a kick out of it.
Right, right. You know? Wouldn't that be crazy meta if, like, after making 911, Ryan Murphy also started making a show that was like sort of a parody of the type of show 911 is?
I feel like he's too self-serious to be into that. I feel like we'd have to send it to, like,
you
Ian Brennan or something.
You think he's too serious for that?
Maybe. Because, like, whenever you see him responding to criticism of his works, he always takes it so personally. And and so I'm like...
I mean, he seems like such a satirical guy. Like, interested in satire.
And, like, that's the troubling part for me is, like, you know, you're interested in, like, sort of lampooning culture. But then, like, when culture lampoons you, you can't deal with it. Mm. That's kind of like a conundrum I come up against
that's
with
pretty
him.
Pretty biting Ryan Murphy criticism.
Yeah, we need to send it to Ian Brennan is what I'm saying. And then he'll produce it.
Okay, right. Interesting. Well, either way, that's the episode, guys. Sorry we were so negative about it the whole time.
I'm sorry, I just didn't like this one that much. Like, I didn't hate it in the way that I like hated other episodes.
Yeah, and it's
but...
obviously got some iconic moments. Mm-hmm. I thought the Maddie stuff was all pretty compelling and... of course, the you want to go for the title scene is iconic and has been like like canonized by Oliver Stark. I don't mean canonized as in went canon in the fandom sense. I mean canonized like was biblically given sainthood.
Yeah, no, biblically. Yeah,
canonized by Oliver Stark as like that was super gay, and I do think that's special. It kind of makes it special to rewatch in hindsight.
Yeah, he knighted that scene. Yeah, he took out like a broadsword and like tapped it on the shoulders and said, "You're gay."
it's you know, but you can cut this out if you wish. But it's like Buck and Eddie took out their dicks and tapped each other on the shoulders.
And tapped tips.
They were like, "You've been gay knighted."
They started
You've
docking.
Been gay canonized.
Yes, exactly. I'm leaving that in.
So, but yes, this episode on the whole, I feel like we made a lot of dirty jokes in this one. This episode on the whole, it's the show's fault for putting such a sexually charged scene in this episode.
And besides, but society's collapsing. I think, why not? You know, you might as well.
Why not? Yeah. Why not sexualize 911 more than ever? It's interesting because there are some episodes that weave a lot of different storylines with a lot of different characters together in a very deft way that we really enjoy. But this one, it feels like everything's just a little out of sync, like the things aren't connecting that well. The pacing of the Athena storyline was interesting to me, the way they have it set up in the beginning, and then you like don't hear about it for like 20 minutes until they resolve it at the end.
Yeah.
Like that seems kind of odd.
Yeah.
So it's like not really an even balance of all of the story. I mean, trust me, I find it kind of merciful that they didn't make us spend too much time on that, but it is kind of weird. Not everything is that even. The Eddie stuff it's kind of weird that they like bring that up and then it only gets revisited in that one scene with Buck, but we're not really getting at any of the things they brought up about like A, his numbness emotionally, or B, him not connecting with his therapist.
Yeah, like
so I don't know,
the only thing we learn by the conclusion of that like little plot line, that little plot development, is that these two gay boys want to beat each other up in order to deal with their homoerotic feelings that they don't have the words to process or verbalize.
Yeah, which would be a very compelling storyline if it were at all intentional or expanded upon. But unfortunately, it's just the somehow unintentional, accidental thing that happened.
Yeah, and that's where we leave it. So with that, thank you guys for listening. And follow us on social media. First Res Podcast.
Check out our spelled gay Eddie-sode on our Patreon.
We just made a gay Eddie-sode for our Patreon, our second Patreon bonus episode. So if you're interested in hearing us litigate the pros and cons of gay Eddie in character, right?
Well, I wasn't really in character, and I honestly didn't do as good a job arguing as Ryan, because like I kind of pictured that we would like have our bullet points and we would just kind of go through our points and discuss them together. But then I got on the call and Ryan's like, yeah, we're going to do this like in real courtroom where you present all your arguments and then I present all my arguments. And Ryan had prepared like a character. He gave the performance of a lifetime as like a Southern homophobic lawyer.
I broke out my Stanislavski training from college. The actor jumped out.
Oh, yeah.
I had to do it.
You disappeared into the role. And I was just sort of stumbling over my words like, he's repressed and he's Catholic.
And I'm so here
even
like,
though I
these
do believe...
gays can't be corrupt in the use of America.
Yeah, so even though I do believe that the argument for gay Eddie is more compelling than the argument against, I think you did technically win the court case, which is unfortunate. But I think like the court of public opinion is still sending Eddie to the gay electric chair over the straight firing squad.
That's what the comments are saying. And as not as the character, but as myself, I have to agree with that. And I'm very happy about it. So keep doing it. And if you want to listen in, go litigate the case yourself. Okay. It's a great, big fun time. And of course, we do end up whinging about queerbait eventually at some point in the convo.
Oh, yeah. And fandom opinions on Ryan Guzman as well.
Of course, of course. So have fun. Fly free, little birds. It's a good time.
Fly free. And remember, life hits you head on sometimes. And so might an ambulance. So that's why you should always look both ways before crossing the street or crossing an intersection with your car, especially if you are on the way to your debut concert at the LA Phil.
Nailed it.